Well, that's interesting. Those of you listening on the podcast, I guess I inadvertently recorded all that other information as well. So we will just pick up where we left off, and maybe I'll figure out how to edit that, but who knows? But we just concluded rule 1.8, and now we turn to rule 1.9, talking a little bit more about conflicts of interest. The main thing to remember is that conflicts of interest are in general imputed. In other words, they are not your conflict of interest. They are a conflict of interest that belongs to your entire firm. So if you have a conflict of interest, so does your partner, so does your associate, so do your employees, so does your employer. It's imputed to all the attorneys in the firm. And we'll talk about that in a little bit more detail in Rule 1.10. But Rule 1.9, first of all, we'll quickly cover the subject of your duties to your former clients. And the rule is a little bit more complicated wording than it really needs to be, because your main duty to your client, to a former client, is the duty of confidentiality. Because remember, under Rule 1.6, everything that happens is confidential. Everything that you learn, know about your client is confidential. Well, that confidentiality prevails. That confidentiality continues even after the attorney-client relationship has ended. So that makes Rule 1.9 pretty easy to apply, because you have all this confidential information about your former clients. Well, you probably can't take a case directly adverse to them because then you can't use all that information that you know, because that confidential information that's confidential for you because of your prior representation, well, that might even be common knowledge with everybody else. But from your perspective, it's confidential. So you really can't adequately represent your new client under Rule 1.9 because you have that confidential information and you're not allowed to use it. So how can you help your present client? So that's how to resolve most former client situations, despite Rule 1.9 being a little bit more verbose than perhaps it has to be. Turning to Rule 1.10, talks about imputed disqualification. And like I say, remember, all conflicts of interest are imputed. But how does that affect your getting a new job? That's most of what is addressed in Rule 1.10. The general rule is that conflicts of interest that you bring with you to a new job are your personal baggage. So in other words, let's say I'm in Minnesota, and let's say that I used to be the general counsel for 3M Corporation. So I have a conflict of interest because I can't bring cases against 3M because they're my former client. And I have all this confidential information. So, well, you decide to hire me, and I come to work for your office. The moment you hire me, you now have a conflict of interest, and you can't take cases against 3M because I brought that conflict of interest with me. The day after you hired me, a potential client hobbles into your office who was injured with a 3M product. And, they have a multi-million dollar product liability claim against 3M, and it's a slam dunk. It's the easiest case you've ever had. It's going to be worth a lot of money. They say, will you take my lucrative case? And what you have to tell them is, I'm sorry, we can't take your lucrative case because we have a conflict of interest. But you stop and you think about that just a little bit, and you think to yourself, well, wait a minute, is that really what I want to do here? You decide, you ask yourself, what's more important than the future of this law firm? Is it this new lucrative case that just walked in the door, or is it our employment relationship with Attorney Clem, who we just hired yesterday? Well, you think about that for about 5 seconds, and you tell the client, excuse me just a moment, and you walk into my office and you tell me that I'm fired, and I pack up and I leave. Well, at that point, you don't have to worry about that conflict of interest anymore, because that conflict of interest was my personal baggage, and I took that with me as I left your employ. Now, if I had, you know, maybe left information behind about that, you know, prior client or something, it might have been different. But in general, conflicts of interest in that situation are the personal baggage of the person that you're hiring, and they take that conflict of interest with them when they leave. And that's pretty much what Rule 1.10 has to say. Rule 1.11 covers the specialized situation of what if my former employer was not the public sector but the private sector. Or I mean, the other way around. I didn't work for 3M. I worked for the Hennepin County Attorney's Office in Minnesota. I was a prosecuting attorney. Well, if you interpreted Rule 1.10 strictly, well, who was my former client for my at my old job? That was the state of Minnesota, because I was prosecuting people on behalf of the state of Minnesota. So does that mean I can never have cases against my former client? Well, no. Rule 1.11 says that, that would be kind of a ridiculous situation. So instead of worrying about who the former client was, we instead worry about the particular cases I was involved in. So we don't look at don't worry about who the former employer was, but I can't switch sides. And I was prosecuting this particular case. I can't switch sides and become the defense attorney for that person. But I can have other cases against my former client. But even that rule might limit my employability a little bit, because I was prosecuting hundreds of cases. And I probably had cases against every firm in town. So does that mean that no firm can hire me? I'm stuck forever working for the government? And the answer is no, because I can be screened off. So even though I was prosecuting somebody that's being represented by your firm, you can still hire me, but I can't have anything to do with that case. You can't talk to me about it, and you can't share any portion of the fee of that case. But I can still go to work for your firm. That's what Rule 1.11 has to say. The other thing that Rule 1.11 talks about is former government employees of any type, not just former attorneys, but former employees of any part of the government. The example I always give, because I become a former government employee once a year. Coronavirus situation in November is such that elections take place as usual, and I am working as an election judge, collecting a government paycheck. I am a government employee for one day a year. The day after the election, I wake up on Wednesday morning, and I am now a former government employee, and Rule 1.11 applies to me. And Rule 1.11 says that as a former government employee, I cannot use confidential information that I learned in the course of my government employment. As an election judge, I actually have access to a lot of interesting confidential information or non-public information, like names and addresses of voters. Maybe that would be helpful in my private practice of law, to look up the address of this person we're trying to sue. I can't do that, because that would be improper use of that information. Number one, I would get fired from my government employment, because we're not supposed to do that. Number two, I might face criminal charges for misuse of data. But number three, under this rule, I would be in trouble as an attorney for making use of that confidential information. Then there are restrictions on if you have a government job, you can't seek employment from the people you are up against. And Rule 1.12 pretty much says the same thing with respect to former judges. Former judges can't represent
people that they were presiding over their cases. In pretty much the same fashion as a former prosecutor. Even if you're not a former judge, Rule 1.12 might apply to you if you were ever an arbitrator or mediator. Those same rules would apply to you there. Rule 1.13 talks about your duties with respect to an organization as a client. So you don't represent an individual, but you represent a corporation or an organization or a government agency. Rule 1.13 makes clear that if your client is an organization, well, then your client is an organization. And you do not owe any duty to individuals within the organization by virtue of that representation. Now, you might represent individuals within the organization. If you represent the trucking company, you might represent the truck driver who was in the accident. Or if you represent the corporation, you might represent the president of the corporation. Or if you represent the city, you might also represent the police officer who is getting sued, or whatever. You might be representing somebody within the organization, but whenever that happens, that is a joint representation with the potential for a conflict of interest. So that rule makes that clear. And it also lays out the situations in which you might have an obligation to be a whistleblower. If you witness illegality within your organization, you might potentially have the duty to be a whistleblower and bring it to the attention of somebody within the organization who's capable of putting an end to that wrongdoing. So in other words, you discover that your client is dumping toxic waste. Well, you're the lawyer. You're supposed to know that that's illegal, so you try to tell the boss to, make them stop dumping the toxic waste. That's generally what your duty is. And in a perfect world, that works out great, and they stop, and you're the hero. But things don't always go quite that well. And when they don't, you might even get fired. Now, normally when you get fired, you don't have any more obligations with respect to your client. This is an exception, though, because even after you're fired, you might have a whistleblowing duty to basically bring it to the attention of the decision maker in the company who could put an end to it. Or possibly even bringing it to the attention of the government agency responsible. Because once you turn them in, if it's ongoing wrongdoing, well then by turning them in, they might get in trouble for what they've already done, but you'll stop them from getting into trouble in the future. So hopefully you don't work for an organization where you have to worry about that too much. And when you get in one of those situations, that's certainly the area where you want to get some outside legal advice yourself, because obviously you're there are huge confidentiality issues, but you might have that obligation to be a whistleblower under Rule 1.13. Well, now, as you recall, in Rule 1.2, we told you that the client is always right. If the client tells you to do something, that's what you have to do, unless there's an exception. And one of those exceptions is stated in our next rule, Rule 1.14. Because that says that if a client has a diminished capacity, so because they're a minor, they're under 18, and you were the court-appointed attorney or whatever, or they're mentally impaired or some kind of identifiable reason, then Rule 1.14 permits you to depart from what they tell you to do. So in other words, if you're a regular client without diminished capacity, wants to, send money to the person in Nigeria that they got an email from, well, do your best to talk them out of it, but ultimately that's their decision. And you can't, you should probably quit. We'll talk about quitting in a little while. But as long as you continue to represent them, you can't, hinder what they want you to do. Unless the reason they're doing it is because of their diminished capacity. So your normal client just wants to, send money to the Nigeria scam person, Well, you have to let them do it. But if they're doing that because they have diminished capacity, it's because of their mental impairment, it's because of their senility, then you can take steps to stop. You know, so when they're walking into the Western Union office, you throw yourself in front of the door so they can't do it. Or more likely, you know, get a guardianship or something set up. Or talk to their family members about what's going on. Because normally you can't do that because, you know, your client tells you what to do, unless it's a case of diminished capacity. So the moral of the story is that, you know, this is an affirmative defense. You are going to be the one to have to establish that there was diminished capacity. You can't just say that, well, you know, I thought better, you know, I thought I had a better idea than my client had. So, but Rule 1.14 authorizes you to take action, even contrary to your client's stated wishes, in that limited situation of the client with diminished capacity. Rule 1.15 is one area where I'm going to actually assign you some homework, because Rule 1.15 starts out in very general terms, just telling you that you have to be careful with respect to your client's property. The specifics, though, it's mostly talking about your trust account, and it tells you two very important rules. First one is money belonging to either a client or a third party, in other words, any money that's not yours that comes into your hands in connection with a representation must always, always, always go in your trust account. It can't go in your personal account. It always has to go in your trust account. And there are really no exceptions to that rule. The other part of the rule is that money belonging to you can never be in your trust account. In other words, they always have to be totally separated. That last part of the rule, your money being, there are two exceptions where it's okay to have your money in the trust account. And those are money belonging to you and the client jointly can be in there for just as long as necessary to separate it. So you get the settlement check, and two-thirds of it belongs to the client, one-third belongs to you. You deposit it and then promptly disperse it. And the other exception is you can keep a reasonable amount of money, e.g. $100, according to somebody who worked for the Iowa Supreme Court, who told somebody that's kind of like the magic number, and that's a pretty reasonable number. But you can keep $100, a reasonable amount of money of your money in your trust account to cover bank service charges as they come up. You can't keep $1,000 of your money in there to cover bank service charges because that's not reasonable for that purpose. Well, what about if you want to keep a little bit of a cushion in there just to make sure that you don't accidentally bounce a check? Well, no, you're not allowed to do that. You're only allowed to keep a small amount of your money in there. So you can't rely on having a cushion. You just have to be careful with your trust account because what you never want to have is an overdraft in your trust account because they're required to report that to the state. So you don't want that to happen. So anyway, that's the short version of Rule 1.15. Now, your homework is whatever state you are in, there will be additional information that probably when you send in your annual bar renewal, you have to check the box saying, yes, I read the following. In Minnesota, it's called... I always forget if it's Appendix 1 or Appendix A. I should learn that. But Minnesota has a separate document called Appendix 1 to the Minnesota Rules of Professional Conduct, which lay out the very specific rules about record keeping and so forth. And you should really read that on an annual basis. So go to the Office of Lawyers Professional Responsibility website, and somewhere there you will see this appendix to the Rules of Professional Conduct, and read it. That's your homework. Iowa has a similar document. I think Nebraska has a similar document. Wisconsin has the rules in a little bit different place. They are right in Rule 1.15. So your homework as a Wisconsin attorney is to... download the official text of the rules and read Rule 1.15. And on the first page of the course materials, there's a link to the rules. Because there are a lot of very specific rules in there. Wisconsin, more than other states, there are, like, for example, well, maybe they're just more specific about it because it would be problematic elsewhere. But, for example, can you accept credit card payments to fund your trust account? And the short answer is no. So, you know, your client says, you know, I want to, you know, or you tell your client, you know, I want a retainer of $1,000 and I'll put that in the trust account. And they pull out their Visa card and say, can you charge it to this? Well, the answer to that is no, unless you have very specifically set up your credit card charge account to comply with a bunch of rules that I don't understand. Really, that's probably, even though the Minnesota rule I don't think covers that specifically, I think it's probably the same. And the reason why you can't do that is because normally with a if somebody pays with a credit card, there's always the possibility that they can dispute the transaction. And what happens if somebody disputes the transaction? Well, the bank takes the money out of your account. And the regulators are just such that they're very antsy about anybody being able to take any money out of your trust account without your consent. So that's why it's problematic. So when the client pulls out the Visa card and says, can I, you know, pay the retainer with this, you tell them, I'll give you a ride to the bank, and you can get a cash advance and pay us that away, because it's really impossible take that. One thing I've always noticed about Wisconsin, if you're a Wisconsin attorney, I would be in violation of the Wisconsin rules, because they're very specific that everything connected with your trust account has to have the words trust account written on it with no abbreviations. I'm pretty good in that regard. My checkbook says trust account. My deposit slips say trust account. But the bank statement uses an abbreviation. My bank statement comes to me addressed to Richard P. Clem, MNLTAB, I think is what it says. And LTAB stands for Lawyers Trust Account Board, so it's an abbreviation of trust account. But Wisconsin says, no, the bank statement has to have the words trust account right on it with no abbreviation. So I'd be in big trouble there. So So your other piece of homework as a Wisconsin attorney is to go pull out your bank statement and make sure it has the words trust account on it. But also, like I say, read Wisconsin Rule 1.15 or the ancillary document in other states. Rule 1.16 says that, yes, you can quit whenever you feel like it. First of all, it says there are certain cases where you have to quit. If there's a conflict of interest or some violation, or you're not physically able to continue on, then you shall withdraw. But then the rule goes on to say in very verbose language that, you can quit representing a client whenever you want, because it lists a bunch of circumstances, including other good cause. So the rule says, you can withdraw from representing a client whenever you feel like it. Well, it doesn't say exactly that, but that's pretty much what it says. But we don't have to worry too much about what exactly it says, because it really says you can always withdraw from representing a client unless the exception applies. Well, the exception applies very often. And the exception is, even though you're otherwise permitted to withdraw from representing a client, you still have to comply with any court notice or permission requirements. So, for example, the rules of civil procedure will say that before an attorney withdraws, they have to notify the court. Well, you still have to do that, even though you've been fired or you're quitting. The criminal rules probably say you need the court's permission before withdrawing. And in, I guess different states will vary a little bit, but Minnesota, that said permission will never be granted, basically. So that exception kind of swallows up the rules. If you quit or your client fires you, you have to give them back their file. You have to give them back their papers. And don't read too much into the phrase where it says You have to give them back their papers if the client is entitled to them. Well, the client is entitled to them. The only reason they put that language in there was so that if, you know, you're drafting this work product, you know, you're writing this contract, and they haven't paid you for it. Well, you don't have to give them that, but you have to give them back all their other stuff. You can make copies. You can maybe even make your client pay for the copies, but you can't condition return of the file upon payment of copy costs. Rule 1.17 says that a bona fide sale of your law practice, if you're really selling out, you know, you're leaving the practice of law, then that's permitted, even though that's kind of like a referral fee. But it has to be a bona fide sale, and to make sure that there are some kind of common sense requirements in Rule 1.17. A prospective client is covered by Rule 1.18, and a prospective client is somebody who comes to you about the possibility of forming an attorney-client relationship, and they communicate with you. They talk to you. They say, will you be my lawyer? And Rule 1.18 says that any information that you get during that conversation, that's just as confidential as if they would have been an actual client. And in fact, that rule is subject to abuse a little bit, because maybe they want to, you know, I want to keep you off the case. So I come in and say, hey, can I hire you? And then I start blurting out damaging information. Well, I've probably kept you off the case. Now, if you took reasonable precautions to keep me from blurting that information out, even though you are off the case, perhaps your partners can still take the case against me. But Rule 1.18 says that information is confidential. So there, after it's been about 2 hours now into our three-hour program, and we have just finished Rule 1. Rule 1 was kind of an important one, because that deals with your relationship with your client. So that's why it takes up so much of the program. We will finish in the next hour. Other rules don't take quite so much time. So in fact, we'll get through Rule 2 here in about 5 minutes. Rule 2.1 just says that when you are giving advice to your client, you have to give your independent professional judgment, but you're not required to, but you can give them advice in addition to legal advice, such as moral, economic, social, or political advice. So just because you're a lawyer doesn't mean that you can't talk about those things. Don't worry about Rule 2.2, because there is no 2.2. It covered the situation of disputes with clients, and it was not adopted in most states. The next rule, which in Iowa, Wisconsin, and Minnesota is called Rule 2.3, in Nebraska it's called Rule 2.2, says that if you are evaluating a case on behalf of your client for a third party, that's an appropriate activity for an attorney to do. But it just makes clear that if you are giving an opinion on behalf of your client, you know, either formally or informally, make sure that it's informed consent if you're telling negative information about your client. So your client wants you to write a letter to the bank saying, yes, in my legal opinion, my client is duly incorporated in the state of Minnesota. So I look up the information, and it turns out, oh, they forgot to send in their renewal last year. So I guess I'll send a letter to the bank saying, don't loan my client any money because they're not duly incorporated. Well, no, obviously before you do that, you have to get the client's informed consent. The next rule, which has differing numbers in Iowa, Minnesota, and Nebraska, it's Rule Iowa, Minnesota, and Wisconsin, it's Rule 2.4. In Nebraska, it's Rule 2.3, says that if you are a third-party neutral, such as an arbitrator or mediator, then you have an affirmative obligation to clear up misunderstandings by those who misunderstand your role. So, as promised, see, Rule 2 went a lot faster than Rule 1. Now, Rule 3 and Rule 4 is kind of the heart of the rules. you're an ethical lawyer, and you know that ethical lawyers aren't supposed to lie, cheat, and steal, and do all kinds of dishonest things. Well, Rule 3 and Rule 4 list all the dishonest things that you're not supposed to do. So they say, don't lie, cheat, or steal. Well, we're going to go through those rules very fast. Not because they're unimportant, because, you know, you're not supposed to lie, cheat, and steal. It's very important. But the reason why we're going to go through them pretty fast is, number one, well, I think you already knew that you were not supposed to lie, cheat, and steal. You didn't have to pay me to tell you that. And number two, assuming that I'm wrong about you, maybe you are going to lie, cheat, and steal. Well, me telling you to probably won't make a lot of difference. So, it's not worth going into a lot of detail on this. But we're going to hit the high points and maybe see some of the ones that are kind of something that you might not have thought of. Rule 3.1, for example, says that you're supposed to present only meritorious claims and contentions. You're not supposed to bring frivolous claims or frivolous defenses. So you knew that. The exception is, no matter how frivolous it is, in a criminal case, if the client wants to plead not guilty and put the state to its proof, that is their right. And that applies any time there's a potential deprivation of liberty. The state has to prove their case, no matter how frivolous that defense happens to be. Rule 3.2 says you're supposed to expedite litigation. You're not supposed to delay simply for the sake of delay, but you should expedite litigation consistent with your client's interests. So if it's in your client's interest to delay, well, then delay is what you should do. But you should expedite things consistent with your client's interest. You're supposed to be candid toward the court under Rule 3.3. You're not supposed to lie, make false statements of fact. You're not supposed to, make false statements of law, et cetera. You already knew that, so we're not going to spend a lot of time talking about that. You're supposed to be fair to the other side. You're supposed to be, Rule 3.4 says you're supposed to be fair to the opposing party and counsel. Now that's, in the abstract, that sounds good. You sound like a fair person. I'm a fair person. You want to be fair. And most of these you kind of read through, it kind of makes sense. You're not going to falsify evidence. You're not going to make frivolous discovery requests. But sometimes as a zealous attorney, maybe you need to kind of push the envelope on some of these, such as that last one. You're not supposed to request somebody other than a client not voluntarily give information to the other side. So you are talking with the witness who saw the accident, whatever. He tells you what happened. He's going to be a witness. Can you tell him, the other side's attorney is going to call you, and he's just a jerk. Nobody in town likes him. He's the worst attorney in town. So when he calls you, you don't have to talk to him if you don't want to. That might be the appropriate thing to say. But if you do say it, you have to be aware of this rule and be careful and make sure that you fit within this rule. Because you just requested that somebody other than your client not voluntarily give information to the other party, because the other side has a right to talk to them. So the burden of proof will be on you that you fit within the exceptions here. And they probably would, because you reasonably believe that that person's interests will not be adversely affected. But beware. Again, the burden will be on you to show that it was proper for you to say that. Rule 3.5, you're supposed to be impartial and show some decorum in the tribunal. You're not supposed to disrupt the trial and do all kinds of, things. But the one here that's, I don't know what your practice area is, but maybe you don't even do litigation. You don't know anything about trials. You're never going to set foot anywhere near a court room. Even for you, there is still a part of this rule that you have to watch out for, and that involves jury contact. Now, if you are a litigator, you certainly know the rules that you're not supposed to communicate with jurors and so forth. You know all about that. But let's say you're not a litigator. You don't. Maybe you don't even practice law on a regular basis. You're just maintaining your license. This rule still applies to you because it says during a trial, a lawyer who is not connected with the case is prohibited from communicating with jurors concerning the case. So how could that come up? Because you don't even know where the courthouse is. But your neighbor just got picked for jury duty, they know that you're a lawyer, so they come and talk to you and say, "Hey, guess what? I just got picked for jury duty." And then, so what you're supposed to say at that point is, "Well, great, be sure you do your civic duty, blah, blah, blah." And that's fine if you say that. But then they start blurting out information about the case. They start saying, "Here's what I think happened, and I think the defendant is guilty, and I don't like his lawyer." And they start talking about the case in violation of this rule. Well, first of all, they should know better because that's what did the judge tell them before they went home. They said, "Don't talk about the case with anyone." That's exactly what they're doing. But unfortunately, you can get in trouble for that because you're a lawyer and you should know better. And you are violating this rule because you are communicating with a juror concerning the case. And that applies to any case anywhere. So your Facebook friend in Australia who's on a jury, that applies to you. And if it gets really bad, then you have an obligation to bring it to the court's attention. So if you don't know where the courthouse is, well, you better find out because you have a duty to report this jury misconduct. So like I say, even if you're a litigator, you know you're supposed to be impartial and have some decorum, but these jury conduct rules apply even if you're not involved in any kind of a case. Rule 3.6 talks about trial publicity, and when you read through the rule, you think they're talking about criminal cases, but they're really talking about any jury case. And there are some restrictions on you, is that in any case that might be heard by a jury, you are prohibited from making public statements that might prejudice the jury. That sounds good in the abstract, but on the other hand, we also have a First Amendment in this country. So it seems to me that, why do we have a First Amendment? Well, so that we can prejudice decision makers. So, if you decide to make public statements on behalf of your client, to get their side of the story out in the newspaper, because maybe some of those people reading the newspaper will be potential jurors, you are to be commended, in my opinion, and I think you are properly representing your client, but be aware of this rule that somebody else might interpret it in another way. So, in other words, be careful anytime you make public statements in something that might become a jury case. At this point, I better give another code number for our podcast listeners, and that would be E-487. E-487 is our next code number for this portion of the program when we finish talking about trial publicity. Rule 3.7, you're not supposed to be a witness in a case in which you're also an advocate. And if you are a prosecutor or former prosecutor, you'll want to look carefully at Rule 3.8 because prosecutors have a duty to make sure justice is done, not just to get convictions. And also, you might have a duty that continues maybe for the rest of your life, that if you ever discover that you were involved in a case where there was some kind of miscarriage of justice, you might have a duty to rectify that. So that's kind of a heavy duty if you're a former prosecutor to always remember. Rule 3.9 talks about your duties in a non-adjudicative proceeding. So you're testifying before the city council or the legislative committee about something or other. Well, this rule simply says that if you are there as a representative capacity, you have to disclose that. So in other words, you can't just try to pass yourself off as a concerned citizen when really you are there, you know, representing, you know, somebody. So there's a zoning hearing on whether they can, you know, build a new glue factory. And you come in and say, hey, I live in the neighborhood. That'll be great if we get a glue factory. Well, you have to disclose, oh, by the way, I'm here representing, you know, a client, you know, the glue factory. You don't have to identify who the client is, but you have to point out that it's that you are there as a representative. Okay, so Rule 3 is kind of your duty to the judicial system. Rule 4 is your duty to the rest of the world. You have to be truthful in your statement to others. You shall not make a false statement of material fact to anybody, ever. Well, that sounds good in the abstract, but there might be, again, times when you want to push the envelope on that a little bit. For example, can you employ a tester in a civil case? So you, your client thinks that they were discriminated against because of their race. Well, how do you prove a case like that? Well, you prove it with circumstantial evidence. And one really good way of getting circumstantial evidence is you hire two actors. So let's say it was discrimination in housing. So you you get two actors, one black person, one white person. And you send them in to the landlord's office and say, hi, we want to rent an apartment. And the white person is told, why, yes, let's take a look at this nice apartment we have here. The black person is told, I'm very sorry, we don't have any vacancies right now. Well, you are to be commended for your zealous advocacy of your client and bringing that landlord to justice. You did exactly the right thing that you should have done. But you have to be aware of Rule 4.1 because those actors acting on your behalf made false statements of material fact because they said, hi, I want to rent an apartment. And that was a lie. That was a total dishonest statement. But courts looking at that will say, no, that's a legitimate investigative technique, so that's permissible. But anytime you engage in that kind of legitimate investigative technique, you have to be mindful of this rule, Rule 4.1. You have to be truthful. Rule 4.2 is kind of absolute, and you cannot communicate with other people if you know that they're represented by an attorney. If you are going to send in your testers, you better do it before the other side gets lawyered up, because once you know that that landlord has an attorney, you can't send your testers in there anymore. You have to send the testers into their attorney and say, hi, Mr. Landlord's attorney, we want to rent an apartment from your client. You know, will you discriminate? You know, that's not going to work very well anymore. So that's an absolute rule. You can't communicate with people that are represented by counsel. If you're communicating with somebody who's not represented by anybody, that's okay, but you have to you can't give them legal advice other than the advice that they should get their own lawyer. And you can't state or imply that you're disinterested. You have to respect the rights of third parties. You can't do things just to embarrass, delay, or burden them. Watch out for that. Rule 5 kind of talks about the respondeat superior parts of the rules. First of all, Rule 5.1 and 5.3 kind of say the same thing with respect to your employees. So in other words, you are the boss. Can you get in trouble for things that your employees do? And the answer is yes. First of all, if you tell your employees to, you know, commit a rule violation, well, you're obviously going to be in trouble for that. But beyond that, you have to make sure that there are reasonable systems in place to prevent misconduct on behalf of your employees. You can't just bury your head in the sand and hope for the best. You have to make sure that there are systems in place to keep that from happening. For example, you're no good at bookkeeping, so you have somebody else handling your trust account. Well, you know, that might be an appropriate thing to do, but, you know, you have to make sure you maintain some oversight. The easiest way, and this would prevent so much fraud and everything, is if you have one person writing the checks and taking care of the checking account, that's fine. You should be the one opening the bank statements and just looking through the checks and making sure everything looks okay, because you're not going to be able to spot, sophisticated embezzlement, but most embezzlement is not sophisticated. Because especially you always hear about the trusted church secretary who, absconded with $1 million from the church. Well, you know, that almost always could have been prevented if somebody else was opening the bank statements early on in the process and saying, well, wait a minute, why are all these checks being cashed at the casino? You know, so that that would usually solve a lot of those issues. You don't have your head in the sand is what Rule 5.1 and 5.3 says. Rule 5.2 talks about your responsibilities as the employee. Can you get in trouble for things that your boss did? And the answer is yes. You can get in trouble for what you did, and it's not a defense that your boss told you to do it. So in other words, the I was only following orders defense is not a defense. With one exception, though, and that is that if you ask your boss for their reasonable resolution of an arguable question, even if it turns out they're wrong, you may rely upon what they told you to do. Now they might get in trouble because they told you to do it, but as long as it's reasonable, that's okay. And we covered Rule 5.3. It's really the same as 5.1, but it's worded a little bit differently dealing with your non-attorney employees. Rule 5.4 says you can't share your fees with a non-attorney. Now, Rule 5.5 is entitled Unauthorized Practice of Law, and the one thing that you are incapable of is the unauthorized practice of law. You can never commit the unauthorized practice of law in your state because, well, you're authorized. You can't, so it's that's you don't have to worry about that. But Rule 5.5 talks about the multi-state aspects of it. So in other words, what are you allowed to do in states where you are not admitted? So, for example, I am admitted in Minnesota only. I'm not admitted in any other state. Can I go to Wisconsin to take a deposition? Can I go to Iowa to assist another attorney? Can I give legal advice to clients in Nebraska? This rule answers questions like that. The important thing to remember is that in answering those questions, you do not look at your own state's version of Rule 5.5. You look at that other state's version of Rule 5.5. They're very, very similar, so you don't have to worry about it too much. But you don't have to worry about your home state's version of it. You have to worry about that other state's version. So if you're a Wisconsin attorney, well, you know, look at the Minnesota Rules of Professional Conduct to see what you're allowed to do, or I, as a Minnesota attorney, would look at the Iowa rules to see what I'm supposed to do in Iowa. What can I do? Well, you can do a lot. As long as you're not disbarred or suspended anywhere, and that suspension in some states might even be for things unrelated to discipline. So if you got suspended because you decided just to let your registration in a third state lapse, that could come back to be a problem. So never just let your registration lapse, formally resign or whatever in that state. But as long as you're not disbarred or suspended, you can do things in connection with a lawyer who is admitted in that state. So even though you are in a different state from me, I can come and work for you. You know, you have a backlog of work in your office, so I come to work for you. While I'm in your office, I can do everything you can do. I can advise your clients on the law in your state. I can do everything as long as you are actively participating. I can do things that relate to my practice back home. So as a Minnesota attorney, if I want to go to Wisconsin to take a deposition in my Minnesota case, yes, I can do that because that relates to my practice in my home state. And I don't need to hire a Wisconsin attorney to assist me or anything like that. That's a permitted activity. The one thing that's really big that really gives a broad amount of power to practice in another state is services that are reasonably related to a pending or potential case in that other state if I reasonably expect to be authorized to appear in that case. So in other words, I have a Wisconsin resident client who gets into a car accident in Wisconsin, and there's no connection whatsoever with Minnesota, but they decide to call me in, and I come over and, start getting ready for this litigation. I'm not admitted in Wisconsin. I'm not even temporarily admitted in Wisconsin. I have nothing in Wisconsin. But I looked at the Wisconsin court rules, and it says that a Minnesota attorney, it's really easy for me to get waived in, and they will let me practice in the Wisconsin courts. So that really is pretty powerful because I can do everything to get ready for that litigation, even if that litigation never actually happens. Or, for example, if I know that I can be admitted in federal court in that state. So for example, I'm admitted in the Southern District of Texas. I don't practice there or anything, but I'm admitted there, so I can get ready for federal cases in the Southern District of Texas. I can get ready for federal cases in the Northern District of Texas, even though I'm not admitted there, because I know that it's just a matter of, paying the fee and sending in the proper papers, and I will automatically get admitted. So anything that can possibly turn into a future federal case, it's pretty broad, and everything might turn into litigation. And also anything connected with federal law. Is authorized. What I'm not allowed to do in that other state is I'm not allowed to establish an office or systematic presence. So I can come to your state to meet with clients, but I can't have an office there. Now, the rules will vary a little bit on the question of what if I'm working for a company that has offices in many states. So let's say I'm working for Wells Fargo Bank in Minnesota. And then I get transferred to their Iowa office. Can I still give legal advice to my employer? And the answer is yes, but it depends on the state. So for example, yes, Iowa allows me to do that very specifically. Other states though, like Wisconsin and Nebraska, require me to register with the state Supreme Court, and some of those registration requirements are more burdensome than others. So if I got transferred to Iowa, that would be great. It's pretty much automatic. If I got transferred to Wisconsin, I would have to jump through a couple of hoops, but I think they would. I would be permitted to continue on in that regard. If I got transferred to Nebraska, the procedures are actually very burdensome in that situation, and it would actually be a lot easier for me just to be admitted to practice law in Nebraska. So if you're ever in that situation, if your employer wants to transfer you to another state, you better look at those rules. Rule 5.6 says that you can't have basically covenants not to compete. For lawyers in Nebraska, Iowa, and Minnesota, but not Wisconsin, there's a rule 5.7 talking about law-related services. So in other words, if I'm doing something similar to the practice of law, like maybe tax preparation, do the rules of professional conduct apply to me in my tax preparation business? And the answer is yes, they do if it's not distinct from the practice of law. So if I have my office, my combination tax office slash law office, well, then I have to worry about conflicts of interest and everything else for my tax clients. In other words, but on the other hand, if I get a part-time job at H&R Block, I probably don't have to worry about that quite so much. Wisconsin does not have that rule, but they have a separate rule with that number. If you are practicing law as an LLC in Wisconsin, Rule 5.7 has some extra guidance that you have to look at there. Okay, so in our we got about a half an hour left. We'll actually get through all this stuff, I think. Rule 6 talks about pro bono, because as you know, lawyers are supposed to do pro bono. Sometimes it seems like that's all I do. So, what exactly is your obligation? Well, your obligation is that you should aspire to provide at least 50 hours of pro bono per year. You don't actually have to do it, but you have to aspire to do it. So on January 1st, you know, you wake up, my New Year's resolution is I'm going to do my 50 hours of pro bono this year. Well, then you've satisfied it. But if, you know, on January 2nd, you wake up and say, you know what, I'm not going to do my pro bono this year after all. Well, then you've violated it right then. So but you have to aspire to do it. But what exactly, what is the 50 hours? 50 hours of what? Well, it's 50 hours of services for persons of limited means. So not, you know, so for example, there are other laudable things you're supposed to do, like protect civil rights and all kinds of other stuff. But normally, your pro bono obligation is without fee or a very, very low fee for persons of limited means or organizations that serve persons of limited means. That's what your obligation is. And you're supposed to do all that other stuff too, but that's not a number of hours set aside for it. So you're supposed to do civil rights, public rights, you know, the environment, charitable organizations, et cetera. But that doesn't count for your 50 hours. You're supposed to do other things too, like improve the legal profession, et cetera. And you're supposed to accept appointments. You're not supposed to seek to avoid appointments. So if you know you think the judge is going to appoint somebody to represent this unpopular defendant, you know, don't sneak out of the courtroom to avoid appointment. You have to be open to that. Well, the rest of Rule 6, because you have these special requirements to do pro bono, is that as a result, some of the conflict of interest provisions are watered down just a little bit to compensate for the fact that you're doing these laudable things. So, for example, if you are you answered their call when the Legal Aid Society wanted you to serve on their board of directors. That was a good thing for you to do. But the Legal Aid Society is going up against some of your private clients. Rule 6.3 says you don't have to worry too much about that. If it was a private law firm, that would, you know, if you worked for two different law firms that were suing each other, that would be the, you know, a horrible conflict of interest. But in that public interest situation, Rule 6.3 says it's okay as long as you recuse yourself from decisions affecting that. Rule 6.4 says you answered the call when the Bar Association put you on the committee to rewrite the probate code in your state. Well, some of your private clients liked the probate code the way it was before. Rule 6.4 just says that you have to disclose those potential conflicts. If you are taking part in a legal clinic of some kind, Rule 6.5 says that if you're not aware of conflicts of interest, you don't have to worry about them. You don't have to screen quite as actively. And that, if you're doing the legal clinic as part of a law school or a bar association, kind of a non-profit thing. that 6.5 relaxes those conflict of interest rules a little bit. Okay, and then Rule 7 talks basically about the advertising rules and communication. Rule 7.1, first of all, says that all public communications, anytime you talk to, the reporter shoves a microphone in your face, well, you're prohibited from making false or misleading communication. So be honest in your dealings with public media. Rule 7.2 specifically turns to the subject of advertising. And yes, you can advertise. What you can't do, it starts by saying you can never give anything of value to somebody to recommend your services. So in other words, no referral fees. Remember we said back in Rule 1.5, this is where it really says no referral fees. Referral fees are illegal. But there are some exceptions, and one of the exceptions is the reasonable cost of permitted advertisements. So yes, you can pay basically a referral fee. You're paying the newspaper money to say nice things about you in the print ad, or you're paying the radio station to say nice things about you in the radio ad. That's kind of like a referral fee. You're paying them to send people to you. But that's permissible because it's a permitted advertisement. And it's pretty much wide open what you can say in your advertising. You can't be false or misleading. But really, the only substantive restriction is that your advertisement has to have the name of the lawyer or law firm, or of at least one lawyer or law firm responsible for the ad. So, in other words, if you put up a big billboard, the intersection where, the dangerous intersection, there are crashes all the time. So you put up a billboard there saying, injured, call 1-800-INJURY, and that phone number rings in your office. Well, you can't have the sign just say that. You have to have it say, this ad sponsored by, Joe Smith attorney. You can even, change the name of your law firm to, 1-800-INJURY LLC. That would be okay. But the ad has to have the name of the attorney or law firm. That's really the only substantive restriction on advertising. Now, advertising, of course, has been kind of controversial over the years. It's only in the last several years that Iowa rewrote the advertising rules to conform to what they are in front of you, that they are in every state. It's pretty much wide open what you can say in advertising. Even before those laws were liberalized and allowing advertising in a lot of situations, even before that happened, you as an attorney were always allowed to have direct contact with prospective clients. So in other words, can you go down to the courthouse and get the names of everybody who got arrested over the weekend and and send them a letter saying, guess what, I do criminal defense. Can you do that? And the answer is yes, you've always been able to do that. Now, there are some restrictions, and these restrictions will vary a little bit from state to state. So check your own state's version of the rule. You can do it in writing. You can't have direct contact. You can't call them on the phone and say, I understand you were arrested. Can I represent you? But you can send a letter saying that. But the restrictions are, first of all, there's some magic language that might vary a little bit from state to state on what has to be printed on the letter and on the outer envelope. And I believe advertising material is the words that have to be on there. But check your state rule before you do that. There might even be a rule about what size the print has to be when you have the word advertising material. And in some states, such as Wisconsin, Iowa was considering this, but then they didn't adopt it. So Iowa does not have this rule. Minnesota does not have this rule. But Wisconsin and some other states have a rule saying that you have to send a copy of that advertisement to a certain office of the Wisconsin Supreme Court. So somewhere in Madison, they have this giant file cabinet of these letters that lawyers have sent to people over the years, and you're required to send that. Then there's an affidavit that's supposed to go with it and so forth. So if you do engage in that kind of advertising, like I say, in Wisconsin, you have to comply with that rule to send a copy to the correct address. And it seems to me that that's kind of a common sense thing, because if I was going to, I mean, that doesn't, I probably wouldn't do that kind of advertising, but, you know, if I was going to do it, that sent, knowing that I have to send a copy to the Supreme Court is probably the thing that would keep me more, you know, on the level than anything. So I think that's kind of a good rule. But that's the rule in Wisconsin, and a number of other states have that. So you have to watch out for that. Can you say what you do for a living? Oh, of course you can. But you have to be careful, and it hasn't always been the case when you could tell people what you did for a living, surprisingly. Yes, you can communicate whether or not you practice in a particular field of law. And because patent law has always been in that category, the rules specifically say if you're a patent lawyer, you can say one. Or if you're if you practice in admiralty, you can say that you're a proctor in admiralty. But you've always been allowed to say those two things, but now you can say anything that you practice in a particular field of law. With one exception, and that is, be really, really careful not to use the word certified or the word specialist or any word even close to that. So in other words, if you do only drunk driving cases and you have no interest in doing anything else, you can certainly say, I limit my practice to DWI cases, or I work in the area, do this area, or I limit myself to this kind of case. You're allowed to say that, but don't say I specialize in it, or because the reason why is because if you use that magic word, specialist or certified, then a whole different set of rules kicks in. And those rules vary a little bit from state to state, but in general, you have to use the word specialist, you have to be a certified specialist by an agency that is permitted to do that. So, for example, in Minnesota and Wisconsin, there is a state board of legal certification or whatever that gives the seal of approval to the Minnesota Bar Association to certify people. And it varies a little bit from state to state. Iowa, for example, does not have such a thing. So if you use those magic words, the C word or the S word, certified or specialist, you have to include some magic language in your ad saying, the Iowa Supreme Court does not certify specialists in any area of the law. So anytime your ad contains the word certified or specialist, those special rules kick in, which you may or may not be able to comply with. So don't use them. And the example case on that one, I don't think it went to litigation, but this a hapless New York lawyer put on his LinkedIn profile that he specialized in tough cases. It was just a little bit of advertising puffery, but the New York bar authorities came to him and said, okay, can we see your certificate that says you're a certified specialist by the National Association of Tough Cases? And he didn't have that, so he had to stop using that. So the best rule of practice there is just don't use those words. Don't say certified, don't say specialist, because those special rules kick in. And that reminds me, we have to give our next code number for this portion of the program, which is E-512, E-512, E-512 is our next code number for this portion of the program. Before we turn to firm names and letterheads, the name of your law firm,
You can call your law firm anything you want these days. You can use a trade name. You can use, Tough Lawyers, LLC, or whatever. It just can't be false or misleading. But more importantly, it can't imply any connection with a government agency or a charitable legal organization. A couple of pointers to watch out for. Don't use the word clinic in the name of your law firm, because some courts have looked at that and said, well, the word clinic implies that it's a nonprofit. I don't know. Most medical clinics are making a profit. I don't know why they think a legal clinic shouldn't make a profit. But apparently they think that word implies that it's nonprofit. So you don't want to use that. But more importantly, don't use the name of a geographic place that is also a political subdivision. So in other words, if you are located in Madison, Wisconsin, don't call yourself Madison Attorneys, because there's a government agency called the Madison City Attorney's Office. Or if you're in Polk County, Iowa, don't call yourself Polk County Attorneys, because there's a government agency called the Polk County Attorney's Office. Or if you're in Minnesota, don't call yourself, Minnesota Attorneys, because it sounds like you're connected with the state of Minnesota. So instead, call yourself, the Badger State Lawyers or the North Star Attorneys or something, Lake Superior Lawyers, because the lake is not a political subdivision. So watch out for that, because a lot of courts have held that a geographic name kind of implies that you're connected with the government of that geographic area. Watch out in Iowa for the URL of your law firm. The same thing kind of applies there. And I know some of these URLs are in use. I'm just pulling this one out of thin air, but DesMoinesLawyers.com. Well, that's kind of problematic. Because it implies that you might be part of the government of that entity. So watch out for that. And I forget which state did not adopt this one. Don't do it even if you're in the state where it doesn't have this rule, because it sounds like bribery to me. But don't accept a government legal engagement if you made a political contribution for the purpose of being considered for that job. I always used the Illinois Governor Blagojevich, as my example there. He eventually got sprung. That's basically what he got in trouble for, violating Rule 7.6. So don't do that. So in our remaining, I think we have about 15 minutes left, we'll talk about the miscellaneous matters covered by Rule 8. Of the rules, which kind of cover everything they didn't think of anywhere else. Rule 8.1 says that you have to cooperate with the state bar authorities in connection with admissions, yours and other people's, and disciplinary matters. If they come to you asking questions about this person who just graduated from law school, what do you know about them? You have to answer those truthfully, you have to disclose facts necessary to correct misapprehensions that you know have arisen. So you have to answer that. Unless it's confidential under Rule 1.6, because you learned it in the course of an attorney-client relationship. A lawyer shall not knowingly or recklessly make a false statement concerning the qualifications or integrity of a judge or candidate for judicial office. Rule 8.2. So don't say bad things about judges unless they're true. If some judge is a crook, you say, well, I think Judge so-and-so is a crook. Well, if they really are a crook, that's okay. But if that's false, if they're not a crook, well, then you violated this rule. So that's kind of easy with respect to judges. It also applies to candidates for judicial office. And every state that's adopted these rules has adopted that exact same language, even though some states
like Iowa, for example, what is a candidate for judicial office in Iowa? Because they don't have contested judicial elections. They have retention elections. So I don't know exactly what a candidate for judicial office is in Iowa. But in Minnesota and Wisconsin, I know what it is. So if you're running for judge. We as lawyers we're a little bit protective of our judges sometimes. If somebody's running against them, contested judicial race, maybe there's a tendency to say bad things about the person who's running for judge because that seems a little bit unseemly. Well, they are entitled to that same protection. You cannot make false statements about their qualifications or integrity. So if that candidate for judicial office really is a crook, well, you should say that they're a crook, but be careful, because if they're not a crook, you have violated this rule. Now, you know, I sometimes go out on a limb. I've had some cases where I have to be careful of this, because I will... my friends ask me, who should I vote for judge? And usually I just say, just vote for all the incumbents. None of them are particularly bad this year, so just vote for all the incumbents. We had one incumbent, though, that for various reasons, it was my opinion that people should vote for the challenger. And in fact, he was voted out of office. Kind of a tragic case, but anyway, I had to be very careful there because I was I did indeed say negative things about this judge, and I was very careful. What I did is I quoted public documents. The Board of Judicial Standards had said something about it, so I quoted their opinion when my friends asked who to vote for. But similarly, in a contested judicial race, we had kind of a perennial candidate. She used to be a perennial candidate. I think maybe she finally stopped, but she, ran for state Supreme Court, every time there was an opportunity, and she, in my opinion, she did not have the proper judicial temperament, and, so I said so. I told people, don't vote against her. Vote for the incumbent. But I had to be careful because if I didn't want to say anything negative about her qualifications or integrity unless it was true because of this rule. So you do have to be careful when you talk about judicial politics. You want to be careful because Rule 8.2 applies to you. We as lawyers are kind of held to a pretty high standard as to what our statements are. Rule 8.3 says that you are supposed to report any professional misconduct you become aware of. If you discover that another lawyer or that a judge is doing something dishonest or improper, well, you have an obligation to turn them in under Rule 8.3. Unless you know it because it's confidential information because you were representing the person or that you were a counselor in a lawyer assistance program. Most states have a lawyer assistance program. In Minnesota, I believe it's called Lawyers Helping Lawyers for attorneys or judges or even law students. Issues, mental health issues or chemical dependency issues or things like that. They have a place to turn. So a counselor there learning information, well, that information is confidential, and they would not be required to report that. If you become aware of misconduct by another attorney, you have an affirmative obligation to report them or of a judge. Rule 8.4 covers all the miscellaneous stuff that they didn't think of elsewhere. You can, even if they didn't think of it elsewhere, you are guilty of misconduct if you come under this laundry list that varies from state to state, but most are pretty much the same. Violate the rules, commit a criminal act that reflects on your honesty, trustworthiness, or fitness. So, or any conduct involving dishonesty, fraud, deceit, or misrepresentation, even if it was not listed up above, even if they forgot to include it in the rules, or any conduct that's prejudicial to the administration of justice, or if you state or imply an ability to improperly influence a government or a judge, if you bribe the judge, you're certainly in trouble. But if you imply that you have the ability to issue bribes, that's no good either. You're not supposed to knowingly assist a judicial officer in conduct that you know violates the rules, or commit a discriminatory act. And here the states, the rule is worded a little bit differently in every state, most states make clear that if you commit an act of discrimination, illegal discrimination, that reflects upon your fitness to practice law, even if it was unconnected to the practice of law. So you're a part-time lawyer and you're a part-time landlord, and in your landlord business you discriminate, on race. Well, that reflects upon your fitness to practice law. So you're potentially subject to discipline. That might be a mitigating factor that it does not, it's not connected with the practice of law, but it is still a violation. Now, that's the Minnesota version of the rule. Some states, that rule is in there, but it's written in a little bit more general terms. Engage in any kind of harassment in connection with the practice of law is probably a violation. And some states like Nebraska have if you're not paying your child support, you're subject to discipline as an attorney for that reason. So, and again, other states might have kind of a laundry list of things that they forgot, or maybe things that some attorney did and they realized it wasn't in the rules, so they added it to the rules. So Rule 8.4 kind of covers miscellaneous. The final rule here, and before we give the final rule, I guess I should give the final code number for our podcast listeners. That would be E-665, E-665, is our last code word. And Rule 8.5 talks about, kind of multi-state issues, disciplinary authority and choice of law. What if you're admitted in more than one state? Which state's rules apply? And which state has authority to go after you for disciplinary violations? A real practical reason where these issues came up was by one Michigan attorney who took my program, and I learned from her that Michigan permits referral fees. And this attorney was admitted in both Michigan and some other state. I forget if it was Minnesota or Wisconsin, but let's say it was Wisconsin. She was admitted in both Michigan and Wisconsin. Wisconsin does not permit referral fees, but Michigan says, sure, why not? You can get money for referring a case to a lawyer. If she collected a referral fee in Michigan, would she be risking her Wisconsin license? So Rule 8.5 answers that question. So first of all, on disciplinary authority, it says if you're admitted in a state, the state where you're admitted can punish you for conduct even if it took place in some other state. Similarly, you can be a state Supreme Court has jurisdiction to punish you even if you're not admitted in that state, if you are in that state or if you're offering to provide legal services in the state, either legally or illegally. So if I go over to Wisconsin to take that deposition, perfectly legal, the Wisconsin Supreme Court potentially could impose some discipline on me. The rule makes clear that you can be subject to disciplinary authority in more than one state. So, both Minnesota and Wisconsin can punish me for that conduct. The choice of law provision, which answers the question of that Michigan attorney, what happens to the referral fee I get in Michigan? Well, first of all, for conduct before a tribunal, the law of that state applies. So that probably settled the issue for her because it was a referral fee in a Michigan case. That it was pending in Michigan. So that rule probably settles it. So, yeah, Michigan rule applies. But if you're admitted in only one state, then that state's rule would apply. So in general, for me, I only have to worry about Minnesota rules because that's the only state where I'm admitted. But the other rule that might kick in, if you are admitted in more than one state, as she was, then the rules of the jurisdiction where you principally practice shall apply. So her office was in Michigan. Her only office was in Michigan. So, yeah, she was admitted in Wisconsin also, but she didn't have an office there. So the default is that Michigan rule applies unless the conduct has its predominant effect in another state. So if it was a Wisconsin case she had gotten the referral fee on and it had its predominant effect in Wisconsin, then she would have been subject to that different Wisconsin rule. So that brings us to the end of our program here. Before we conclude, I will just ask our live callers if they have any questions. I'll pause briefly for that.
No question here.
Okay, and hearing none, I will, for our podcast listeners, if you do have questions about the content of the program, or even if you're taking it live, feel free to shoot me off an email. And the rules of your state say I'm supposed to answer within, I don't know, 2-3 days or something. I usually get to stuff like that right away. So if you do have questions, feel free to send an email to clem.law@usa.net or give me a call. And for information about other programs, feel free to check out my website, richardclem.com. So thank you for joining us today.